The following message was paid for by Visit Philly and the Philadelphia Chamber of Commerce. Hi, I'm Will Meneker, co-host of the politics-based comedy podcast, Chapo Trap House, here to tell you to come check out the great city of Philly. Do you like the musky, lived-in feel of the classic New York City bodega, but hate all the unnecessary windows and signs? Visit Philly for stores with no windows, but plenty of cigarettes, hoagies, and fruit salad for sale.
Are you sick driving all around the city to find a sports stadium for baseball game, the minor league team, the hockey team, the professional lacrosse team, and the football team? What if there was an unincorporated zone a little bit outside the city where all the stadiums are next to each other that's desolate, where all hope has gone to die? Come to Philadelphia, the only city with an arena zone.
Yeah, you know, I don't know where the Eastern Block is. That sound kind of gay to me, yo. But I know that on my block, we got 15 Ogie shops. We got four places you can get your tires taken care of. And we got a big spray paint black vending machine that you put money in and nothing comes out.
Do you like the cosmopolitan feeling of a big northeastern city, but hate the pressure that comes from having to wear clean clothes? Visit Philly, a Chapo Trap House partner and city. Chapo, episode 27. Let's go.
What did you think of the new Ghostbusters?
The new Ghostbusters with a bunch of females running it. Bullshit.
Oh, yes.
That's bullshit. Yes. There's an attack. There's an attack on men. Do the Obama administration. Because he's texting his girlfriend.
Hello. We're back again. It's episode 27 of Chop My Trap House. It's me, Will Meneker, joined as always by Felix Peterman.
Hello, everyone.
And Matt Chrisman.
What's up, yo?
As you may have heard from that wonderful cold open, we love the city of Philadelphia. We just spent all this week in Philly covering the DNC, and it was a fucking blast. We had such a good time.
We love Philadelphia. Like, we obviously make fun of it a lot because there are a lot of windowless bodegas that advertise fruit salad and have no air conditioning and all the food is cooking within its wrappers. And it seems like half the stores are tire shops. But we legitimately fucking love Philadelphia. It's incredibly fun. The people are great. And a lot of gray wolves, most importantly.
Yeah. Yeah. Most importantly, a lot of fans of us are in Philadelphia. We closed out our amazing week with our fantastic live show with a street fight at a venue that was an indoor batting cage during the day, and it was like one of the coolest things ever. So, huge thank you to everyone who came out to the show, who we got a chance to meet and hang out with. That was so cool, guys, and thanks again to everyone who came out. And to anyone who couldn't make it, we will have audio of the live show, which was hysterical, with us and Street Fight, available as a premium episode this week. And not only that, we'll have an extra premium episode for you this week. There'll be two premium episodes this week because we didn't get one for you last week, obviously, but hard to complain because we were in a forward operating base. We were in the middle of a kinetic ongoing operation. And, you know, it's hard to record when you're taking fire.
There's also only one modem in Philadelphia, and we didn't have it that afternoon when we tried to record.
And, you know, that's mostly taken up by Eagles message boards.
We got banned from the Eagles message board, which is the only internet available in Philadelphia, and couldn't get you a premium show last week. But sit tight. We got two coming for you in the week up. And also, we should definitely, just at the top of the show, give a huge shout-out to our two hosts for this week. Baltimore Matt on Twitter, at Baltimore Matt, and Captain Freiheit on Twitter. Nick and Matt put us up for the week. So huge thank you to them. And a special shout out to Nick and Janine and their art gallery, Ellipses. It's artellipses.com. We're going to put a link up to that. They run an art gallery out of their house. So if you are an artist in Philadelphia, or if you know anyone who is that is seeking to display their work and representation, definitely check out artellipsis.com, Ellipsis Gallery, ran by Nick and Janine. It was super cool. I bought a print from them because I'm a man of who loves fine art and purchasing it and displaying it in my many homes. But definitely huge shout out to them. Both, they were such gracious hosts the whole week to put up five sweaty men in their house. It was really great, and we had such a good time hanging out with them.
I mean, we were definitely the sweat boys.
The show was fantastic. It was hysterical, and you guys are. I'm really excited that if you weren't to the show, you're going to get an opportunity to hear the audio. We talked about all the fun shit we did in Philly, but there's a few things that didn't make the cut, and just one of them now, we got the opportunity to go to a party hosted by the Climate Hawks. I wasn't familiar with this. It's some sort of environmental fracking, anti-fracking organization. It was an open bar at Fergie's in downtown Philadelphia. But the price for the open bar is that we had to listen to some intersectional climate activists stand on the table that we were sitting at and give us their spiel for about 20 minutes. They were cool. We heard Josh Fox, director of Gasland, the documentaries Gasland 1 and 2 talk. He was pretty cool, but while the audience was cheering him, we did get an impromptu chant of Love That Boy going. So I feel like we were kind of dicks to Josh Fox, but he was standing on our table. So
look, if loving that boy is wrong, I don't want to be right.
But yeah, so that was our Philadelphia trip. Again, it was super fun, but for our guest this week, we're talking to Bro Pair, also known as Dan O'Sullivan. And we had a long conversation with him that I felt was sort of appropriate coming out of, like, the funnest week ever, is I feel that like we sort of a sobering experience now that the conventions are over. I think I said back in one of the early episodes that I wasn't looking forward to when the conventions are over and it's, like, just the election. I said it was going to be depressing as hell. And it totally is. And our interview with Dan was a good one, but I think it kind of reflects that. It was one of our more sobering episodes. What do you think, guys?
It's a little bit of a downer.
It's a bit of a bummer, but, you know, I think for one thing, I'm very proud of us that we finally lifted our ban on allowing the Irish onto the show. They are filthy, but, you know, a few of them are good, and he's one of them, Dan. And the other thing I wanted to say, because I realized that I might not have actually explained this term when I used it in the interview, is I refer repeatedly to the concept of kayfabe, which is a carny and wrestling term for the fake reality that is put on in a show, like the idea that the Ultimate Warrior and Hulk Hogan really hate each other and are enemies as opposed to coworkers. And breaking kayfabe is something you're never supposed to do until you do it for, you know, a real powerful effect. But so keep that in mind during the interview.
Yeah. So let's do it. Bro Pair, Dan O'Sullivan, everybody. Dan, I guess I want to begin. I think I saw something that you wrote. It was either on Twitter or on the FB, where you said basically being in Cleveland for a week covering the Republican National Convention, you got to, you know, witness this grotesque spectacle of, like, the end of our democracy and civilization, but you had the funnest week of all time.
Yeah.
And I feel we had the exact same experience in Philadelphia. It was a fucking blast, but all taking place behind the backdrop of the horrible, grim spectacle of this cursed election in the year of our Lord 2016.
It's basically like Cabaret.
Yeah. Well, and you raise a good point. I got back, and the first thing I did was I'd had a few books I wanted to read, that I thought could come in useful or handy for the election. And so I finally, you know, just pulled the trigger on it and got, you know, a good history of Weimar Germany, you know, what else? A Diary of a Man in Despair about watching the rise of the Nazis. Just all this beach reads that I can read in August to just get really pumped up for it. So
Hans Vallada, check it out.
Yeah, right. Him too. Yeah, I mean, I think I say the Weimar thing half joking, but I did have an identical experience in Cleveland, or not identical, but I had a great time. But it was always with this, you know, ultimately really a very dark backdrop to it.
Well, what were some of the things you guys got to see and do there? Because Brian and I were there a couple days, but we had no, like, hookups or credentials or anything, so we just kind of wandered around.
Yeah.
Did you guys get into anything more exclusive?
First off, Cleveland is great. The Clevelanders are great. And they were really welcoming, just in general, you know. Notwithstanding the massive police presence, the, you know, thousands of cops from all over the country, the highways being shut down and all this. And yet somehow it was very surreal, but ran very smoothly, which was, again, part of this weird, dark backdrop to it, right? The local Clevelanders we worked with, especially the local Cleveland journalists who kind of showed us around, you know, they were really awesome. And so, yeah, we got to kind of, we did not have credentials, me and Jeb Lund, to go into the Quicken Loans Arena. So we couldn't go in what the, you know, the restricted zone or whatever it was called. But that was, we were fine with that. And we were interested in what was going on outside of it. And, you know, like, so I see, you know, he turned to me at one point and says, "Is that Corey Lewandowski over there?" And I literally ran down the street after Corey Lewandowski.
Did you grab his arm firmly and go, "Corey"?
Yeah, I didn't need to. And you know, he's in kind of this like shark skin suit. He has the cop haircut, the cop sunglasses, and it was just him. So, you know, I walked with him a few blocks down a street interviewing him while he's looking for whatever steakhouse he's going into, and he's lost. Let me put it this way. Nobody I asked to speak to in Cleveland said no, which now, is, you know,
did you get a chance to talk to any Trump supporters or, you know, never Trump conservatives or any of the true believers?
Oh, yeah. You know, the I would say my favorite people to talk to there were the Trump supporters, because their reasons were just very interesting. I'm not sure quite how to put this, but it is remarkable to talk to a Trump supporter and come away with the impression of, I don't agree with what they're saying, but I can see how and why this person came to support Donald Trump, which is maybe a controversial thing to say at times, to betray any sort of empathy towards people like that. But, you know, the impression I got was he speaks to a lot of real anxiety and real pain, and you see that in his supporters.
Well, I went to that. I was at that rally too, the Bikers for Trump rally, where Alex Jones showed up.
Yes,
talked about the globalists.
Yeah,
and I felt that same thing hearing people talk. Like I said this on the show when we talked about Cleveland. This woman went on this big talk about how Hillary Clinton has one set of rules and everybody else has another, and
right,
there's this elite who are totally unaccountable. And I was like, fuck, that is not wrong. There's nothing she's saying that I can say is incorrect.
Right.
But there's one thing about the Trump support, because it's coming, I think, from an authentic place and from pain that's real and from dysfunction that's real and from a collapse in trust for elites that's absolutely deserved. But I think the other thing that's kind of hard to say, because you get the opposite problem of showing too much empathy, is you look like you're elitist, you look like you're a snob, is that a lot of them are kind of dumb.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's true too, right?
Yeah, well, and that's the thing. I remember when I wrote about the Trump rally in Chicago that got canceled.
What the fuck was that?
Hey, what happened?
By God, I think I hear Donald Trump's music.
Well,
that's,
so
that's why we play. That's why we pay Brendan, baby.
Yeah, that's where he makes the big bucks.
That's right.
The stupidity. Yeah. So I ran into this when I was at the Chicago Trump rally too, where it's I had a line in there. I hope you don't mind if I quote my myself because it's such great prose. But no, I'm interviewing this guy. He has a Confederate flag knit cap on. He's talking about why he supports Donald Trump. And I'm just thinking in my head, okay, on the one hand, I sort of see where this guy is coming from. On the other hand, Alan, you seem really fucking stupid. You know,
and this wasn't Alan West you were talking to.
No, I would have felt no compunction about calling him stupid. But you know, I don't know if I want to call it stupidity, but perhaps a lack of education, a lack of you know, being able to suss out bullshit. I think that was more shared by most of the Trump supporters I met. And I do think it is possible to be, and I might really get crucified for this, but I do think it is possible to be an intelligent person who supports Donald Trump if you are coming from that, either out of cynicism or a place of real pain. And for instance, the intelligent people I met who supported Trump, and intelligence being a morally neutral thing here, were probably the white supremacists I talked to, who were very cynical.
Yeah, like if you actually are kind of, if you're like, yeah, if you're fully cognizant of like everything that Trump represents, then you kind of have to be a fucking scumbag to be on board all the way.
I wouldn't.
You just have to have shitty priors to be operating off of. But I think that the point you're making about like not able to suss out bullshit, sort of helping him among people who have genuine grievances. I read this interesting article in ProPublica where they went and they talked to a lot of Republicans in the city of Dayton, Ohio, which has seen in the last 4 years their traditional Republican support basically collapse and it be replaced by these people who are now very enthusiastic for Trump.
Yeah.
And there was an interview with a woman, and she worked at a Safeway gas station near the Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and she said she was in her 40s and she had never voted before in any election because she said, I didn't want to make an uninformed choice. I don't pay attention to this stuff, so I don't want to vote for somebody that I don't feel like I know what they're supporting. But she now supports Trump because she sees him and it speaks to her. And I think that comes down to the fact that she experiences politics as something on television. And until now, it's been too boring to watch. Like you're flipping through channels after work and you come on somebody droning in that, you know, kayfabe American politician talk that's like designed to be boring so that it seems serious. And if you're a consumer of entertainment, you're going to flip the channel. But then, of course, Trump, coming from wrestling and reality TV, he knows exactly how to keep people listening. And all of a sudden, it's like, wow, this guy's entertaining, and so, therefore, worth listening
to. Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And it's the constants that I ran into every time I spoke to a Trump supporter, really, and I really mean, I think pretty much everyone I spoke to who's a Trump supporter, was this emphasis on he understands me. You know, I have never felt like a politician spoke to me before, and he does, and he gets me. And I've never in my life, in my adult life, felt this way about another politician or that kind of thing, you know. And, you know, how do we make sense of this? I think to some degree it's, you know, like for instance, with free trade deals, right? In the 90s, you had Ross Perot talking about it. And apart from that, I can't think of any really other prominent forces in American politics besides the labor movement, which was, you know, not doing as well, decrying that. So when he comes out and he talks about these free trade issues and their corrosive effects on the American economy, he is just, it's an easy layup for him because nobody even bothers to try to capture whoever would be concerned about
that. I think that's a really big thing with Trump, is that he does all these things that it was implied you cannot do, you cannot possibly get away with it. And he does the time-honored technique of whenever they try to shame him, go, no, that doesn't work on me. Like, I think the thing that I will always remember about Trump's campaign, win or lose, in the beginning, was when he says about John McCain, he's like, ah, he's a shitty pilot. He's not a war hero. And I like people who don't get captured. And that stood out to me so much because I remember my entire fucking life Every asshole who lived in New York and D.C. was telling me that I love John McCain. That I love John McCain because I live in the Midwest. And I respect him. And we all respect John McCain. We all love him. And if you come out against John McCain, you know, it's over for you. And he just, he says, he comes out with this line of attack that no one's even done on John McCain. Attacking him for, you know, actually he was a shitty pilot. He wouldn't have gotten to crash four aircraft if his dad, if he didn't come from naval aristocracy. But he, that, you know, he was the front runner before that. Everyone said, no, it's over now. He attacked John McCain and then just nothing happened. And I think that snowball of support, people always talked about his ceiling. Well, he, they go, well, you know, there's 60% of the country that doesn't agree with saying that about Senator McCain, or there's, you know, people, they won't accept if you, you know, refuse to apologize to Jeb Bush's wife. And it turned out no one was following these people's codes of conduct. It was fake. It was completely fake. And it became more and more thrilling to go along with him.
Well, because we worship strength. Like, yeah. Like, strength is this fixed fetish object for Americans, I think. And the one thing that makes you look weak is apologizing for something. And if you can say something outrageous and then power through it and never really even acknowledge that you said something fucked up, you look strong. Like, that's, that is a rhetorical presentation of strength. And I think a lot of people are drawn to that, too.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think this is going to be a funny, or maybe funny-sounding comparison, but in that sense, he reminds me of Christopher Hitchens in that, which, you know, obviously Hitchens was so erudite and, you know, had that wonderful accent and all that, but he never apologized and was always this forthright, brash kind of, here's where it is, I'm a brave intellectual, I'm doing all this thing. And he had a rabid following as a result of that. If you don't apologize, you will, I think, sound like an intellectual phenomenon, just by merit of this brashness that other people look to and aspire to be like, because it, you know, it reminds you of what you're not, right? So, so Trump, I mean, I think Adam Gopnik in The New Yorker, he, you know, I don't agree with everything he's written about Trump, but one thing he wrote about a lot that I like is the idea of, and I, you know, we can get more into it. I believe Trump is a fascist. I came out of this week believing that, you know, under.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
We talked about it on the show. I was really skeptical. And then this week, really, that sealed it for me.
Yeah. I really believe that. And yeah, I can get more into what I mean about that in a minute. But he got Nick made a really good point with The New Yorker saying, if you look at all these countries where a fascist leader had any prominence, he tends to reflect some cultural models of what a successful citizen looks like. So in Italy, with, you know, and forgive the slight stereotyping, but in Italy, you know, Mussolini, he's bombastic. He's flamboyant. He's macho. You know, he's kind of
Like the spicy meatball.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and then Hitler, right? So Hitler is this romantic, dark figure, romantic in the classical sense, you know, a Wagnerian figure, right? And then in Britain, what do you have? You have Oswald Mosley, who's an aristocrat, you know, this aristocratic bearing, this, you know, a cultured way of speaking. And what does America have? We have a billionaire who is has no class, right? He's not a Rockefeller. He's a guy who eats at McDonald's, right? He is a casino owner. He's a reality show host. I mean, this is...
Yeah, I mean, being famous is really the big thing. Like, you want to talk about the archetypal successful American, they're a famous person.
Right. And famous for being famous, for the most part. So, yeah, I mean, I think that... you know, in all of these things, you know, Trump is kind of an aspirational model for a lot of people. And like what you were saying, at the first rally I went to in Chicago, I remember a sweet old lady saying to me, Trump says what I want to say. And that is just so powerful a thing to access, I think. All these anxieties, all these fears, some of them more valid than others. And I'm you know, racism being prime among the totally invalid ones, but it's there. Him being able to say these things and get away without a price, come on, that's very powerful for people who are who feel like they're not heard.
And that's why I think that's why the liberal line of attack against him is so weird, because they cannot they A, cannot process people rejecting liberal values, but B, they can also not process that, okay, what is the liberal line of attack on a guy who has proposed ethnic cleansing? He has proposed a systematic killing of civilians in the Middle East. The line of attack on him is that he's been divorced too many times and he misspells things on Twitter. And to people who aspire to be this guy, who aspire to take all their failures in life and put it to become this guy where they're so powerful, they can just power through everyone who looks down on them, every indignity that they suffer. Why the fuck would that sway him? That's what they like about him, in part.
Well, I made this comment today that it just seems to me that, like, you know, the media, or the liberal media in particular, they keep trying to do this Edward R. Murrow routine with him. Like, they keep thinking that they're going to have that moment where they're like, this is now no longer an election about Republican and Democrat.
Have you no sense of decency, yeah, sir?
This is an election about decency or whatever. And it's like,
well, that's right. Like that Joe, that the Murrow / Joe Walsh,
yeah,
ownage of McCarthy is like, it's this it's in the liberal imagination. It has this, it's this mythic moment where the slavering Neanderthal is banished with pure reason and moral vision and clarity. And like, they've been humping that for 40 years now, and they've been like Sorkin and that whole model of thought. It's all that's like the primal scene of it. That like, and they want to keep getting back to that.
but Dan, let me ask you though. Like, I mean, let's be more specific. What, like, when you say Donald Trump, you're convinced he's a fascist? Like what about that? Like, convinced you of it? And like, what can we point to as examples of this?
Well, let me. I'm gonna pull up an essay here that I found very, I've read it years ago and then I pulled it up again. It's an essay by Umberto Eco called Eternal Fascism, where he identified these 14 features of fascism that he found and that I found very helpful. And, you know, one is a culture of tradition. You know, in Eco's view, he says, you know, these fascists, they tend to be very ideologically slippery. You know, it's not really clear what they believe to some degree. And on issue to issue, they might just, you know, mesh between things. So Trump, for instance, was basically a Democrat, like a pro-business Democrat, with a slight racist edge to him for decades. But basically a New Yorker, you know, in a lot of ways, in terms of his political views.
Or that he was pro-choice or whatever, yeah, which you could also say about the Bush family as well.
Right.
Until it was expedient for them to, you know, have that come to Jesus moment.
Yeah, and I guess the difference there would be, right, Bush Sr., Poppy Bush or whatever, you know, he's on the fucking board of Planned Parenthood until 1980 when he's going to get picked, right? And off he goes. And totally conventional in his beliefs. Now, Trump is, you know, it's like a syncretic mix for him. He'll take a little bit from here, from there, from over there, you know. He's going to take the Islamophobia of the far right. He doesn't really care about gay people, though. He's going to take it from all over the place and say he's, you know, he's a true blue American, right? So I think that the willingness to upset that orthodoxy in favor of what works, what speaks to people, is very interesting and also, you know, troubling.
I mean, that was a hallmark of early fascism. It was like this kind of the first postmodern political movement where its number one focus was gaining power, and all the elements that went into it were secondary to that.
Yeah, I mean, and, you know, I don't know that Trump knows what he believes. You know, Eco goes on to say there's a cult of action for action's sake. And that is Trump. The guy sleeps 4 hours a night. If he's asked about something he doesn't know anything about, and there's a lot of things like that, he will start talking about it at length, you know, and just try to cover it, you know, and try to fit it into his view of the world. I mean, what I wrote about in the piece we're working on is just about this idea of endless invention, like formless invention, that he's coming up with it in front of you as you see him, you know. And this in itself, I think, to a lot of people is a sign of authenticity, that here's this guy, you know, just vigorously speaking. And it really doesn't matter what he's saying. You know, the performance is there. of the vigorous leader who's just taking action. And in reality, he doesn't have any solutions because he's saying things like, you know, what's your plan for defeating ISIS? Like, we're going to defeat them. We're going to kill them. They are gone, you know, and that's it. You know, it's just these, you know, short declarative sentences about action. You know, if you are listening to him and you have the good fortune to be an American of a certain race and skin color, you get to go along with him for the ride. You know,
you mentioned the Umberto Eco essay, which is really good, and we should link to that. If we can, you know, identify these characteristics and sort of understand how fascism works, and, you know, contrary to what you may have heard, we actually don't support fascism on this podcast.
That's good.
Like, how does understanding that, like, if you were interested in defeating Donald Trump per se,
How
would understanding that, like, how would you apply that? And particularly I'm thinking of, like, maybe we should move on to discuss what happened at the DNC this last week, right? So, like what did you see or not see in anything the Democrats had to offer that showed that they had any understanding of what the appeal of Donald Trump or how to counteract it or combat it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I should say off the bat, I was a Sanders supporter. You know, I gave $100 to Sanders I've never given a politician money before. So there's my stuff on the table just out in the open. But
Bernie, bro.
I want to balance this out. I was an O'Malley man. Matt was a delegate for Lincoln Chafee. Uh-huh. And Will is...
I was chafed with Chafee, baby.
And Will is a delegate for Gary Johnson.
Oh, congratulations. The delegate.
Why take the left or right ball when you can have the Johnson?
Hell yeah, baby.
And Bill Weld, of all people. So, all right, so there's my biases out there. But look, I think Sanders had clearly a much better idea of how to defeat someone like Trump. All of this shit driving the Trump phenomenon, it's all kind of what lies beneath. What lies beneath the normal, acceptable parameters of political discourse. And we've talked about that already, right? The horror from, you know, maybe the mainstream about mocking John McCain, when in reality, if you dig a little bit beneath, you will find a lot of Americans who despise that man, and they have, in my opinion, good reason to. And so, you know, these are things that do not make their way into the accepted discourse, right? And Sanders, of course, was, you know, also outside that accepted, you know, standard of discourse. Now, what Sanders did that I thought was really interesting was he got at those same driving forces of alienation, of economic problems, of all this. And he, how do I put it? He appeared tough in a way that I'm sorry, Hillary is not. He could dispense with Trump with mockery in a way that I thought was very effective. And he did that because he wasn't focusing on dangerous Donald or attacking Trump's patriotism or saying he's an agent of Russia or anything like that. He was going for the red meat and the thing that I think draws people to Trump, which is he's a bullshit artist. He's full of it. He doesn't give a shit about you. Here's what and I think that the Clinton campaign is most effective when, for instance, I was really struck. I mean, I'm not impressed with much of Clinton's campaign or what they do. They did a good video on an architect who was swindled out of his work by Trump. He built him this, you know, I think it was at a country club, like the, you know, some building on this country club. And he got swindled out of the money. And they did an effective little 3-minute thing on this guy, you know, having that happen to him. I think that's closer to the mark of where you want to get at him. But, you know, you guys would know more about the DNC than me. I wasn't too impressed with their line of attack thus far.
Well, actually, one of the speakers we saw watching it on TV was a woman her husband was rooked by Trump University and then died or something.
Yeah.
Do you guys remember that?
It was somebody from Trump University.
That was like the intermission to 9/11 night was the Trump University.
Something light. Yeah.
I want to go back a little bit to what Dan said about Sanders. And the thing that struck me the most about Sanders is the debate right before the New York primary, where he goes on this extended thing about Operation Protective Edge and the war crimes that the IDF committed in Gaza. And I go, oh my God, holy shit. And Trump has something that you can confuse as courage. He'll say anything, and he's a rich guy who's gotten this far in bluster his entire life, and so he's just gonna, you can't shame him. Hillary Clinton is, Donald Trump is not braver than Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton is just cautious in a way that someone who had been a politician while this guy had been a reality TV star, an icon in that way, would be. But Sanders was so effective because he was the real article of what you saw as Trump's courage.
I think that's exact. I mean, look, I think the contrast, if it was a Sanders-Trump race, the contrast would be so much sharper. And, you know, I think that part of the phenomenon of Sanders and also Jeremy Corbyn in Great Britain that I don't think is talked about quite enough is a great part of their appeal, in my opinion, is that they appear incorruptible, right? They are openly not wealthy. They have not, they do not owe their success to special interests, and they are willing to say things that are unpopular. And not things that are unpopular in the sense of Trump taking all these anxieties and then turning it on immigrants or Muslims or any of these other groups that he likes to direct this rage at. But saying these hard things publicly and without apology. And Clinton is obviously, she's a moral leper. I mean, she, you know, she doesn't believe a thing. And if she's elected, she will be, her actions and directions will be dictated by whatever the prevailing force is in the wind. And that's going to be really some of the worst special interest groups you could, you know, you could care to name. Look, Trump is willing to say anything. His talent for invention is impressive. But I guess what I fear going into this election now is that that quality of his is going to be more attractive to more people than I would have anticipated a couple weeks ago, in part because of how just corroded and forgettable Clinton stuff is.
You know, you and Matt both talked about coming out of Cleveland, like confronting for the first time the idea that Donald Trump actually is a fascist. And I, this week in Philadelphia, or at least watching the Democratic convention on TV, had the feeling for the first time where I thought, there's a slight possibility Trump could actually win this election. Now, there's a lot of good reasons to think that he won't win the election and that Hillary's pretty much has it in hand. But Matt, I think what you said is that in a straight up bet, you would choose Hillary, but you would take Trump with odds, right?
I would need a decent payoff on Trump.
Now, but what was disturbing about it, at least watching the DNC on TV for me, was I was just thinking, like, okay, well, first of all, it's hard for me to judge these things because I'm so not the audience for these kinds of speeches. You know, like this kind of optimistic, you know, American vision. It's not aimed at me at all. But what I was thinking watching it was, particularly on the, like, on Tuesday night when we were watching, it just seemed like they were bringing out a litany of people who Donald Trump has personally offended. And I was just thinking, like, if you're this mythical undecided voter, I don't get what they're offering you personally, other than that Donald Trump is just a mean guy and a bad person.
Yeah, no, that was my entire thing. They didn't sell Hillary. They had these slickly packaged videos of, like, Donald Trump being like, I think the troops are gay and, like, all this shit. And then they would have Lena Dunham, which, like, I cannot imagine there are that many people who are on board for Lena Dunham but aren't on board for Hillary. Like, I think the Never Trump movement of baseball cranks and bathroom warriors might actually be bigger than that voting block.
Well, okay, wait, Felix, let me correct you. Real quick, though. Kevin D. Williamson said, despite the fact that she molested her sister, he is a fan of Girls, the TV show.
Ugh. That's really, like, the worst position you could take, right?
Yeah.
If you'd come down good differently work, on either side, it would be tolerable, maybe, but I don't know.
Kevin Williams, he's a savant for finding the worst interpretation of any event.
I just really like his Twitter avatar, which is him giving like a cocked eye to the camera selfie, or like one eyebrow raised, because it always reminds me of like a stand-up comedian's headshot in the 80s, like yeah, blazer with the arms pulled up, you know, the sleeves pushed up. Yeah, that kind of look.
Loved by millions, an idol of the people.
Bye, Lucy. So long, Luther. You're right to me now. I'll be thinking of you, good people.
Boy, I'm not letting to shake that dumb.
Look, don't try to play the noble defender of the sanctity of marriage with me, Papa Man. You know where you've been some of those nights when Betty was waiting up for you. You know, you hit me and it'll be all over the papers as much as the people love you tonight.
You're fired. Hit you. I'm not just an entertainer. I'm an influence, a wielder of opinion, a force. A force.
Oh, if they ever heard the way that psycho really talks.
They're mine. I own them. They think like I do. But they're even more stupid than I am. So I gotta think for them.
One of the greatest characterizations ever put on the screen in the whole history of motion pictures.
Maybe I'm just a country boy. But if the president tries to stop me, I'll flood the White House with millions of telegrams.
An important point I think was brought up earlier, which is the media being, look, it's easy to bash the media, but the bubble that does exist in horse race journalism in the election means that you got to be focused every day on what's happening. And the newest thing is what gets prominent in the cycle, blah, blah, blah. You know, the problem with that to me is it elevates events and things that most Americans not only don't care about, but have no idea are happening to a level of prominence. Cable news is not actually watched by that many Americans, if you look at it.
Yeah, nobody watches that shit.
So something like Lena Dunham, most Americans have no idea who this woman is. Most Americans...
I haven't got HBO, motherfucker.
Right. But most Americans, they're not going to see her speech. They don't care. It's just not relevant to their lives. So I think what you're describing with the... you know, with the DNC, I mean, I didn't watch much of it, but I'd be curious to know what you guys think of this. I felt like it was more like a classical Republican convention.
No, absolutely.
There was
a fucking 9/11 night.
Right.
There were generals on stage talking about how dangerous Donald would never have the temperament for war. It felt like 2004 all over again.
I like the positive spin on this is that, you know, this was an event, you know, over the course of four nights, they were appealing to this positive vision of America, our better angels. But I mean, obviously I don't see those better angels. And to me, it just seemed like, yeah, it was a more slickly produced, more essentially positive vision of what the Republican view of what is good about America and why we should all like it.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and that's, you know, the riposte that, you know, just killed me was, and I got to load this up. So this was 3 days ago and Trump just fires out this tweet. Our country does not feel great already to the millions of wonderful people living in poverty, violence, and despair. And that's it. To me, that is it, right? That is the answer to this. That you are not, I mean, this is why I found so baffling the view that, okay, this Obama speech is great, all this is great, America's great already, and it's not. That's not true. It's tangibly not true. And if Trump is going to be the only one speaking to this credibly, we're in a lot of trouble. And in terms of the numbers, I mean, look, in terms of numbers, Mitt Romney... Right. What did he get? 47% of the vote. That was his ceiling. Right. I really don't think he could have garnered much more than that. So the question is, can Trump get more than that? part of the reason I've always thought Hillary would win is I think, look, the white people in this country of the sort who would typically go Republican, they're dying off, you know? They're disappearing to some degree. So I don't know if he's going to be able to come up with the numbers, and he's alienated every other group in this country so thoroughly. What I do, what concerns me is the idea that they are going to go down hard, right? That, yeah, they may not win an election again, but it's going to be ugly on the way out. And, you know, I got that sense talking to white supremacists there. One in particular who was probably the most evil person I talked to there, but was very smart, saying that in a way, maybe it'd be a good thing if Trump lost, because then you have all these despairing people becoming more radicalized. And that's a frightening vision, if Hillary wins in November, because the Democrats will sit back and think, you know, they hit a triple when they were born on third base, and meanwhile, these hordes of Trump supporters have not gone anywhere, and their lives have not gotten any better.
And her inevitable defeat in 2020 is pretty scary, given the forces that Trump has unleashed.
Yeah, I mean, imagine Tom Cotton if he adds a race.
Tom Cotton, baby!
Yeah. I mean, like, the line with the more, I guess, self-aware Democrats is it's not acceptable for us to get, like, a 52-48, you know, or, you know, X amount to third-party candidate. We have to decisively beat Trump. And I look at what is being presented by the Hillary campaign, and I go, well, I don't think they're interested in a decisive win, or they cannot do it with what they're currently beholden to. It's impossible to have a decisive win with what they're presenting.
What they're doing is they're hoping, because you talk about, like, what are they actually presenting as a reason to vote for Democrats, and I think what it comes down to is that, you know, they do have a disproportionate control of media influencers, not necessarily even in the news media, but like media in general, like Hollywood, like TV. And so they feel like, well, this, we can make Hillary cool. We can make being the Democrat cool because the people who arbitrate cool are on our side. And then Trump, we can make Trump look uncool. And that's how we win. But, like, you know, that might help with younger people. I think it probably does. I think that is a large reason that a lot of young people are Democrats, frankly. But at the same time, does it get them out in huge numbers to vote, as opposed to just sort of have a general preference for Hillary? Does it make them feel like they actually have to go and wait in line and vote?
I think it's important to note, and I really mean this, like, as objectively, I think, as I can, she's a fucking terrible politician.
Yeah.
She's just inept, you know? I'm not even talking about the level of malice or anything like that. She's just bad at reading, you know, the political equation. I really believe that.
Leaving aside, any conspiracy theory or the legality of, like, what was exposed in the DNC emails, to me, more than anything, what was exposed is just how fucking dumb these people are. Like, you know, how incompetent the people trying to win this election for her are.
Well, and take her email scandal, right? Okay, so the management of this email scandal clearly went up to her, right? She was the one making the decisions here. Now, any junior prosecutor would tell you, if you have something embarrassing with a witness, you get it out on direct examination so that you don't get torn to shreds on cross-examination, and it's the first time you're hearing about it, right? So this email scandal, to me, the way that they handled it, in that she wanted to get off scot-free and avoid any embarrassment over it, so they dragged it out, and it came out in drips and drabs anyway, and was much bigger, a much bigger deal than it would have been if they just released all the emails to begin with, right? Now, I'm saying that not knowing what was on all those emails, and it seems like, you know, many were deleted. So I don't know. Maybe she was planning, you know, the murder of John F. Kennedy or something on them. I don't know. But, you know, but I think that that's a perfect example of this kind of this Clinton arrogance. Do they have any clue what they're doing? I think that they're running a campaign based on a really dull notion of what Americans would respond to. I think it's clear that as soon as she had dispatched Sanders in the Democratic primary, that they owed nothing to the left beyond, you know, saying that they support a few planks in Sanders' platform. And, you know, I get people on Twitter, you know, angry at me saying, well, she says she supports, you know, universal tuition now and getting rid of, you know, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And, yeah, I guess we'll see when she's elected how long she sticks around on that.
I honestly don't know how you can say that she doesn't know what people want. She brought Mike Bloomberg out, Doug.
Yeah, what the fuck, dude?
She brought out 5'2" of neoliberal sex up and put him on that stage. But, like, that just shows you, like,
Bill Bratton.
Bloomberg is one of the least popular figures in American political history to the vast majority of Americans. People on the right hate him because he wants to tax their sodas and their trans fats and hates guns. People on the left hate him for stop and frisk and for filleting Wall Street. There's only this tiny little sliver, like counties, you know, towns like Raytheon Acres, Virginia, and, you know, like Servants Interest, Connecticut, that like Bloomberg. And she's like going, it seems like she cares about winning those counties. She'll lose Ohio, you know, but she wins, you know, like I have three speedboats, Rhode Island or whatever.
Well, and that's the thing. I interviewed a guy at the convention who was a small town Ohio Republican. Nice guy. And, you know, was, I think, genuinely disgusted with Trump, you know. You know, he said something that, I think nailed it, which was, I feel like the Republican Party has moved over to Trump and the Democratic Party is moving over to me, you know. And look, I think, you know, if Obama was a moderate Republican of the 70s mold, I mean, Hillary Clinton is becoming a moderate Republican, quote unquote, of the 90s Newt Gingrich mold, you know?
Well, I mean, there were actually people talking about how, like, Trump, you're no Reagan.
Like, yeah.
You fucking assholes, Reagan sucked. If anyone on Earth is supposed to be aware of that fact, it's supposed to be you idiots. I leave you with a word.
I'm glad Reagan did. By the way, I think that's Tom Skaka at Gawker had a great piece the past couple days called Trump is a Republican. And
that was
it was very good.
And it tracked with just a, you know, look, I wrote this in the piece that we're working on, but Trump has picked up the ball that Richard Nixon originally put down, and he's carrying it, and he is absolutely, absolutely a part of that tradition. He is the most vulgar iteration of it, maybe, but the racial politics, the contempt, the appeals to violent militarism. All of these things are things that were used by Nixon, by Reagan in particular, and by Bush.
Absolutely. Okay, what has been the big thing the past 2 days? Trump attacking a dead veteran. How did Bush hamstring Kerry in 2004? He said that they basically said that he stole valor.
Band-Aids, yo.
Yeah.
The purple Band-Aids of the 24 RNC.
This has always been around. Bush helped annihilate McCain in South Carolina by doing robocalls saying that he had a black daughter. I don't know what era of respectable Republican politics these people are looking at. It's always, the hell has already always been here for people.
I mean, my favorite is when you hear people, oh, I'm a Goldwater Republican, you know, which
he is so much worse.
Control of nuclear decisions to like fucking generals in the field.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and Goldwater, I mean, I bring it up here because I like bringing up Goldwater's past as a mafia connected, corrupt shill who helped eject Navajos from their land and, you know, and was involved in importing Mexican, essentially slave labor for the, you know, this is what we're talking about here. There's no clean hands here. And you keep going back. I don't view Trump as significantly worse than Andrew Jackson. If there's a difference, it's that Trump hasn't killed all the people he says he's going to, and Andrew Jackson had by the time he was elected, right?
Yeah, but Andrew Jackson was a fucking Democrat.
Yeah, well, right, and I mean
just
literally
like the Ku Klux Klan.
Yeah, You know, so look, I think going back, the smartest lefties I spoke to in Ohio and Cleveland, the thing that they were focused on was trying to combat Trump on the basis of the things that he speaks to in Americans are spurious, they're false, they will be sold out by him in the end. And I think that that would be the way to win it, to prove that this guy does not care about them. But my concern is, well, Hillary Clinton doesn't really care about them either. So, you know, what are we going to do?
Yeah, there's no, yeah, you can say, oh, he's a crook, oh, he's a swindler, and he's selling you a bill of goods, but, like, what is Hillary doing? She's using this, like, yeah, candy-coated, Hollywood celebrity-filled, just totally empty campaign to sell you more of the grinding neoliberalism that's destroyed your life.
And this sense that Trump is a con man, and, you know, I've seen various iterations of this, you know, I can't believe, you know, whether it's over the DNC or, you know, the emails or Hillary, like people saying, you know, establishment Democratic pundits and wonks, people who say, like, you know, the sheer audacity of attacking, you know, Clinton for being corrupt, coming from a guy who's, you know, made his wealth through just fraud and corruption, basically. And I don't think they're giving the people who support Trump enough credit. I mean, I think they know he's corrupt, but I think the sense is that he will be corrupt on their behalf, whereas like if all politicians are corrupt, but they're corrupt for people like them, whereas Trump is at least offering to cut them in on the deal.
Well, that's like, you know, I spent time in Israel, and that is in Israel, that's kind of how domestic politics are viewed. The expectation, and I live in Chicago too, so also that. But
hell yeah, baby!
The expectation that all politicians will be corrupt. And you just want one who's going to look out for you a little bit. Like, that was really, like, Mayor Daley, the idea with him was he himself really wasn't financially corrupt. Like, he would steer business to family members, that kind of thing. The bigger thing with him was he would let that shit happen, and you were at least cut in on the patronage, right? So there'd be some table scraps for you. And beyond that, who cares? And Trump more or less says this when he says, I have cheated people. I've gotten the best deal possible. That's what a businessman does. I'm going to do that for you now. And look, I think you're being dishonest if you don't think, okay, I get the appeal there. Because in Hillary, we have the second most least popular candidate for presidency ever, right? Trump being number one. So we have the two most hated presidential candidates in history right now. I mean, this
hell
is
yeah, fam.
This is really staggering. I think that inauthenticity that Hillary has is somewhat distinct from Trump's inauthenticity, if that makes sense.
Totally. Like that's the thing is that she, like all regular normal politicians, she is committed to maintaining that. Like I said, that kayfabe, that sense of, I'm going to speak like a politician is expected to speak. But everybody is all aware that it's bullshit, that all her concerns about your... So I saw the Stormer steel workers, and I talked... That nobody is actually caring about those people in the world of politics. It's all glad-handing and all that. And that's like the traditional kayfabe of politics, that people tune out because it's just it's boring. Whereas... That reality TV kayfabe that Trump comes from is got some huge advantages. One, it's way more entertaining. It's designed to entertain as opposed to designed to like put you to sleep on purpose. So it catches people's attention. And then it gives you this illusion of being in on it. Because like everybody who watches reality TV and enjoys it, part of their enjoyment is like, well, I know that part, this is fake and that's fake. And like, I watched The Bachelor. I know these people aren't really in love. And that gives you a sense that you are part of this conspiracy with the creators of it. And then Trump does that. He brings you in to his kayfabe. Whereas the political kayfabe of Hillary is designed to keep you out.
Well, and I think, you know, if we're going in terms of, because obviously these are not, these are all emotional appeals, right? Whatever, you know, look, people do not vote based on their policy preferences. I just think that's the truth if you look at it, right? If people voted based on policy preferences, you know, I think Sanders would be winning in a landslide. It would be the Democratic nominee right now. he's much closer to where most Americans really fall, you know, in opinion polling. But, you know, with Trump, in terms of this marketing between the two of them, I think the salient thing that stands out to me is Trump's mockery of the phrase "I'm with her," where he says that's not how it should be. It should be "I'm with you." And the reason I thought that was so effective, and which this is kind of funny to me, the Hillary Clinton campaign is scrambling to like water that down now and say, okay, on the back of the sign saying "I'm with her," it'll now say "she's with you." I mean, you know,
like that.
Like that's a real thing. But his criticism of that was so effective because "I'm with her," it again fits with this perception she has, I think, of politics as being for her own personal glory and that of her social climbing family, which I'm sorry is just the defining characteristic of the Clintons. And that, isn't it a great achievement what she's doing? Isn't it historic that Hillary's doing this? Blah, 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 blah. And that is not going to be an opinion shared by a lot of Americans who don't understand why they should be happy for this wealthy, power-seeking person.
On Thursday night, after we did our live show in Philadelphia, someone came up to me right after the show and just showed me they just had Twitter and they just showed Politico. Amy Klobuchar had up there, she gave a whole speech. The whole thing was about sex trafficking and about how Hillary Clinton has saved, is fighting sex trafficking here in America. And she was like, people think it's something that happens overseas, but it's going on right here in America, like, you know, next door. She could have basically said, you know, your daughter is next, pretty much.
Yeah, and then, Felix, what was her amazing line?
The amazing line was, you feel like you're doing it.
Amy Klobuchar, my former senator's line was, I don't want a world where girls are captured and sold. I want a world where girls are fearless and bold.
Oh, come on.
No, yeah, that was the big thing we noticed by watching DNC. All the DNC people, they talk like, Smithers is screensaver of Mr. Burns.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, right? Like, you mentioned being entertained earlier. Look, Fox News is entertaining. That's why people watch it, right? Trump is entertaining. He is more entertaining than Hillary Clinton. Now, the DNC actually got better ratings, which I thought was interesting. But look, here's the thing. I feel like the people watching the DNC, it was in large part a way of feeling better about things. And there's a false sense of security in that. Things are not good right now. And the entire, I mean, I really thought the Republican convention, the speeches, they were diseased. They were scary.
Oh, God. On Monday night, that was when it started to turn for me, when the fascism thoughts started to really get in my head, was that Monday night, that first night of the RNC. It was bone-chilling.
Well, I mean, the first night of the RNC, the theme, truly, was death. That was the theme of the night. And the theme of the night being, here is all of the types of death that can happen to you in America. Immigrants can kill you. Taliban can kill you. Radical Muslims can kill you. All of these people can, you know, all of these scary forces can do this. Benghazi, Hillary will kill you. So, it was really frightening and diseased and played upon people's fears. But in a sense, we have some seriously, seriously alienated people in this country. And, I think telling them that everything's okay is not an option.
That's the Democrats did that. I mean, I thought there was, you know, and to be fair, there was a little bit of, you know, I thought Elizabeth Warren, of course, because I already kind of respect her, I thought she did an okay job of both attacking Donald and identifying some real problems in American life and at least identified why Donald Trump would not make them better and would, in fact, make them worse entirely. But I agree. I think the overarching vision that I got from watching the DNC was a kind of they wanted to like take over the Republican brand on patriotism, and it was an attack on Donald Trump's patriotism. He's not, like, this is not our America. This is not the America of Hamilton, basically.
Yeah. By the way, fuck Hamilton.
Both the show and the dude. I'm with you, man. Fuck that guy and that show.
No, that's guys. Fuck Hamilton. We know Trump is Voldemort. Hillary is Hermione Granger.
I can fuck with that.
Election over.
Yeah. If I could, you know, I'll try to restrain my thoughts on being thus far unpublished while any number of takes comparing this to Game of Thrones have gone through the ringer. But I'll try to avoid focusing on that until I can get off the air. But no, it's, you know, look, there's a lot of good journalism coming out about this. But sometimes I wonder, is there going to be a history book telling the story of this race? And people are going to be asking, well, why didn't they stand up to these forces that were coming against them? And there's going to be those, you know, images in the history book of, you know, top 15 ways Trump is... I don't even watch Game of Thrones. Some bad guy on Game of Thrones, right? Who gives
Joffrey,
a shit?
Joffrey.
Sure. Yeah, right?
All right. Let me put it in more appreciable terms. We're going to go to the Animatrix. This thing that more Americans have seen.
Right. Trump's the Hamburglar. Let's just get that out there. You know? That's that one everyone
Trump,
knows.
You know what Trump reminds me of? He reminds me of the rude, cynical, wisecracking driver on Bang Bus who's always denigrating the performers and never gets in and fucks himself. That's who Donald Trump is. How dare you, sir?
No, Dan, I'm going to disagree with you. The Hamburglar has been committing these crimes unpunished for years, and Donald Trump's going to put an end to that. He's gonna make America, you know, safe from all the Hamburglars out there.
Now that you mention it, he does remind me of Mayor McCheese more than the Hamburglar. He kind of
the right color.
Yeah, he kind of looks like
some, and the head shape and all that.
Yeah,
somebody's coming in and pissing in the ball pit.
Yeah, I'm not gonna put up with this. Yeah, right, that kind of thing. You know, so you know we have a lot of race left ahead of us. I mean, I guess going beyond this race, what scares me. You know, and this is something that the white supremacists I talked to were intelligent, they were cognizant of, and I think very cynical about, is the mainstreaming of their views, right? Mm, yeah. We now have a Republican presidential candidate who went on Alex Jones's radio show for an interview, knowing presumably what he was. Maybe they didn't know. I don't know. The point is he went on it, right? Alex Jones was a presence at the Republican convention. You have these white supremacists worming their way in, not just as prominent advocates for Trump, but actual delegates, right? So I guess, you know, you mentioned Tom Cotton earlier, guys like him. You know, a common strain of conservatism is, and I don't think it's commonly attributed to them, but is of creativity, is of reinvention. And in the same way that George Wallace was kind of the stalking horse for Nixon using racial politics, I would be concerned about someone smarter than Trump.
The next guy.
And, you know, someone like Ted Cruz being able to marshal some of these forces. I don't know whether it'll be enough to win the presidency. I hope not. But...
I think that's exactly right. And the way I'm sort of imagining a Trump presidency, to me, the number one scariest thing about a Trump presidency is that I think he would completely cede control of the guy. He would just do whatever the Republicans, and he would not lead. And I think he would just green light anything the Republican Congress wanted to do, which is awful, an awful thought.
Yeah.
But probably closely following that fear is the kind of, and this maybe is a little bit newer and more novel, is the kind of the license that I think it would give, like, in the minds of a lot of people, like you said, who are white supremacists or just racist adjacent, the license it would grant them now, this sort of permission of polite society, I think is also very scary.
Well, and look, the toothpaste is out of the tube, right? So... and you know, and in fairness, and I'll never tire of reminding people of this in my own strident way. Andrew Sullivan believes in discredited, disgusting racial science, and has done so unapologetically for 20 years now, right? and he has no problem being published and having his ideas disseminated, you know, sucking up to Obama or whatever he's doing now. So the Overton window on some of these ideas, it's opening even further. Trump was not the first to open it, but it's a real thing, and I, you know, it's really scary to me. If I can give any optimism after this, you know, depressing screed, it's, I think the Overton window on the other side is opening up too. And
that is absolutely true.
And so, yeah, and you know, I have to say, you know, you can thank Bernie Sanders for making, like you said, openly criticizing this slaughter in Gaza, you know, getting Cornel West into the DNC. These are things that were unimaginable a year or two ago. Look, the fact that Hillary Clinton had such trouble dispatching Sanders at all, that is itself a good sign. The young people of America are not going to go in Trump's direction. I do believe that. Or most of them, you know.
All right. Yeah, well, they need to take over the Democratic Party then, because I don't think we can handle any more of the standard holders of that party being the Clintons to hold back this tide.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. Look, I mean, I'm probably going to vote green in November, but with that said, I think realistically, the only game in town is seizing the Democratic Party and remaking it. Now, that's a tall order. I don't know if it could be done, but
I think if it is,
yeah, it's basically our. I mean, that's the thing. The question if it's difficulty, I think, is far secondary to the very just observable fact that it's really the only option right now.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's the way it goes.
It is, and it's got to move past Bernie himself, you know, because we saw a lot of support for Bernie in Philadelphia. There's a lot of, you know, people angry. A lot of people, I guess, they still think he can pull it out, or maybe not now, but Bernie, he did a really great service, I think, to this country in his campaign. But I think the energy now needs to move on from him specifically to the issues that he brought to the fore, and the kind of, I guess, broadly speaking, social democratic vision that he represents.
Yeah, and I mean, look, in any other country, this would not be considered very radical. You know, America's a strange place in that it has. It's the country for, you know, the labor struggle. And I don't know, maybe that would be controversial. But, you know, I think it's the critical country for many of the things we take for granted as you know, basic labor rights. And then on the other hand, there's this implacable hostility towards socialism, you know. And I think that these are cultural values that need to be abandoned. And part of why Trump is so evil to me is he's taking the dissatisfaction and the pain and anxiety caused by these myths, and he's doubling down on them and saying, well, the reason that you're not happy with this is it wasn't done enough, or it wasn't done in the right way, or we didn't hate the right people enough, rather than trying to disabuse his followers of those notions, you know, which I think is really the only chance we have, you know. And, you know, and against this political backdrop, we may not have much of a choice given the environmental destruction that is going on, you know. So, you know, I don't know what the future holds. My hope is that as things get worse, we get better. But that may be naive. I don't know.
I think that's a good place to leave it. You know, like I said, a little bit of optimism. But yeah, you heard it here first, folks. Vote for Hillary Clinton. Get out there. Sir. Work like hell for her. You know, we can do this. Let's elect the first female president.
People, it's coming. It came.
Hell yeah.
We swerved on you. They were all Hillary, man. You got punked. You got punked by us.
We don't want
all that
a world.
Patreon money is just going to Hillary Clinton.
We don't want a world where women are silenced and booed. We want a world where girls have their ambitions wooed.
You know, you say that, but it could absolutely happen in a couple of days that she says that. I mean,
yeah, no.
We already made the Hamilton thing happen. So, well, you know.
Well, I thought the Pokemon Go one was even worse.
Holy shit,
that was
breathtaking.
I mean, I can't be the only guy who Googled Mongolian passport that day.
Okay. Well, Dan, thanks for taking the time to talk to us, and we hope to see that article soon.
I hope so, too. It's been my pleasure.
Okay, we are back. Again, that was Bropair, a.k.a. Dan O'Sullivan, on the utterly grim reality of the 2016 election. All the fun stuff is over, people, but please don't draw that warm bath. Don't put on that Elliott Smith record right now. The Chapo will be funny again, I promise.
Yeah, no, we have a lot of fun stuff planned. We are... You know, we're going to be doing like a little Mystery Science Theater 3000 bit with Sam Chris. The movie is Triumph of the Will, but we're still going to have fun.
We will find fun to be had in this election. I'm sure there'll be more fun stuff, but we promise we will be there with you the whole way, for the whole ride down. That's almost it for this week's show, but I think I'd like to close out with Chapo Mailbag, some listener mail. What do you say? You want to do a couple letters?
Let's do it.
Okay, first one here. This one comes from David Rooney. He says, "Hi, my question is for Will Meneker. Why are you such a big bitch? Sincerely, Hermit Thrush." I don't know, Hermit. I blame my parents personally, but I feel this is a question that should probably be answered by other people. Why do you guys think I'm such a big bitch?
Well, my answer is pretty simple. I am a Marxist. I go for material analysis whenever possible, and I think it's the fact that you grew up on the Upper West Side, that you are a pampered son of privilege, and like all pampered sons of privilege, you are innately bitchy.
True. I can't argue with that. Is David the real Hermit Thrush, though? Because if he's not, how dare he use
No, that's
slander?
Not the real Thrush. That's not the real Thrush. He's a pretender. He's stealing valor.
Yeah, he's stealing valor from one of the most valorous online personalities. So, David, blocked, reported, banned, sued, done. This next one comes from Matt Corbett, who asks, if the Trap House ever disbands to pursue solo podcasts like a nerd Beatles, what would each of your solo podcasts be about? Also, what are your theories as to why Arthur Chu stopped tweeting? Love to my large boys, Matt Ramone. Okay, Matt, well, let's answer the second question first. What are your guys' theories as to why Arthur Chu stopped tweeting?
I am I'm an Arthur Chu expert. Arthur Chu has not tweeted in like 2 weeks. Only answer is the scientific answer. Simply put, he fried all of his electronics with his wetness.
Matt, do you have any theories?
I have a theory that he has basically turned into a latter-day Henry Darger, and he's locked in a room composing a 20,000-page erotic novel about fucking everyone in Mario Land.
I don't know why Arthur stopped, but all I have to say is, Arthur, come back. Please come back, Arthur. It's not the same without you. We miss you.
We want you back now. We love you.
In terms of, solo podcasts like the Nerd Beatles, I mean, you know, Matt and Felix can branch off on their own when one of our followers just inevitably Mark David Chapman's myself. By the way, if you're a fan of the show, please do not read Catcher in the Rye. Please.
Yeah, no, we need leave to that book that
alone.
You.
Leave that book alone. Well, I think this is a good opportunity. Matt is in the process of planning his own offshoot podcast. I mean, Felix already has about 10 other podcasts.
Yeah, I mean, like, if we broke up, I would just be like, time to do podcast number 48.
Yeah, Felix is already, he's already the master. He is diversified, as they say, in the podcasting realm. But yes, I, this is a good opportunity to let everybody know that, that me and a friend of the show, Amber Ali Frost, are going to be starting a movie-based podcast called Frost/Chrisman. We're going to be recording the first episode, I think, sometime this month. We're going to be looking at new movies, old movies, sort of a lot of based around themes for the episode. The first one we're going to do is, in honor of this election, we're going to look at some 70s paranoia political thrillers, starting with All the President's Men and the vastly underrated Parallax View. And we'll talk about them in the context of their time, talk about them, what they mean to people watching them now. I think it's going to be pretty great.
Yeah, Matt and Amber are doing, I'm actually really looking, I really want to listen to this show, and I'm jealous of how good it's going to be. But it will be, like, you know, in under the Chapo umbrella. You know, we're branching out. We're becoming home base for a lot of excellent content in the future. Yeah. That's the dream.
I mean, like, when Matt starts the podcast, we are going to meet with him in a desert, and we're going to go, Matt, you're attracting too much fucking hate. When you asked us if you could start a spinoff podcast, he's going to go, When I asked you, when did I ever ask you anything, you Jew motherfucker?
You only exist out of here because of me.
You're walking around like Lionel Barrymore with your freaking cigarette holder and your pajamas.
I don't know, Matt. All I said was that, you know, you brought a lot of heat to the podcast, and Matt, you're going to go, if it wasn't for me, every other podcast would take a piece out of your Jew ass. Okay, next question comes from Aaron. He asked, Dear Chapos, we've all heard the left-wing buzzword intersectionality, perhaps more than we ever wanted to. Certain bad actors use it and try to confuse issues, but I feel like it may be a useful concept if used correctly. Do you think that's so, or do you think it's only lefty jargon? Thanks, JJ. JJ, I think that's actually a really good question, and I think it's a question that maybe we should address in a show if we find the right guest, because I think that intersectionality, like a lot of these buzzwords, mansplaining or a lot of this shit, there's a whole dictionary, the whole lexicon of these things that I think, taken at face value, do in fact describe a real thing and perhaps an important context, but online seem to be used only by morons. So, I mean, I don't know. I think this is a topic that deserves further exploration.
Oh, absolutely.
On a future Chapo show.
Because, yeah, I mean, the whole point of intersectionality as it originally was conceived was a way to expand the concept of oppression and solidarity along different axes while maintaining, like, a unified activist and, you know, oppositional front to the oppressive realities of racism and sexism and capitalism. But instead now, yes, by virtue of being replicated over and over again and picked up by the dumbest and most opportunistic shitheads online, it now means the exact opposite of that. It basically is a way to deny any possibility of solidarity and thus any chance of change. But yeah, there was something there originally, and we should talk about it more.
Yeah, no, we should find a good ass guest to have this discussion with, because I think it's an important one. Okay, next question comes from Philip. He writes, "Hey, I think it would be really woke and subversive if you, a Turk-centric and sponsored podcast, had Dan Kay from Montreal on to talk about Armenian issues. Also, it'd be good because he's easily one of the top 5 funniest people on Twitter. Thank you for being you, Philip." Philip, that is a fucking excellent idea. Dan Kay is easily one of the top 5 funniest people on Twitter, and an episode about Armenia with him is a fucking great idea.
We could do a lot of episodes with Dan, because Dan, like, in addition to being an incredibly underrated joke writer, is really underrated in how well-read he is. And, you know, we could do, like, an issue about Gulf countries, or an episode about Gulf countries with him. we could do an episode about Hezbollah with him. There's a lot of shit we could do with Dan. We love Dan. So
yeah,
we're definitely going to have some stuff with him coming up.
Philip, Dan will be on the show. Dan, come on the show soon. Talk about Armenia. And this is actually a related question from Ansel. Asks, hey guys, love the show. I work in Sacramento. You should do a California episode. Our politics are pretty nuts and we have our share of media dweebs. A California politics show would be awesome, and we definitely know some friends who would be excellent guests to break that down for us. So yeah, be on the lookout for those shows coming up in the near future, and be on the lookout for Frost Chrisman, also coming soon to the Chapo network of affiliated podcasts.
Yeah, fuck you, Earwolf, we're coming for you.
All right, I think that about does it. Thanks again to Philadelphia. Thanks again to everyone who came to the show and to the city of Philadelphia. It was one of the funnest weeks of my life. Love you guys. Cheers. Till next week.
Bye-bye.
See you, everybody.
Bye.
Tomorrow morning I'll get up nice and early, take a walk down over to the bank, walk in and see you, and if you don't have my money for me, I'll crack your fucking head wide open in front of everybody in the bank. And just about the time that I'm coming out of jail, hopefully, you'll be coming out of your coma. And guess what? I'll split your fucking head open again, because I'm fucking stupid. I don't give a fuck about jail. That's my business. That's what I do. And we know what you do, don't we, Charlie? You fuck people out of money and get away with it. Hey, you fat Irish prick, you put my fucking money to sleep. You go get my money or I'll put your fucking brain to sleep.
Sam.
Never mind, fucking Sam, this is personal. I'll be there in the morning. You can fucking try me, fatso. You fucking try me. You think you got the point?
What are you doing?